Court is ready to hear oral argument for petitioner and counselor Lee Evergreen Church.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Tim Capolino. I represent the petitioner in this case, Karen Cox. This case, Your Honor, is brought before this court because we feel it's a case of first impression in this state. And we feel it's a very important issue that we feel that this court has to decide at this time. The issue in this case, and this comes from a summary judgment that was granted in Harris County by the 270th Judicial District Court.
Counsel, before you proceed further, what took this case so long to get before? The facts occurred in 86. I'm assuming you filed the time.
Your Honor, we did file what had happened in this case. We had proceeded with discovery at one point in time, I believe, from Mr. Mays, who was representing Ms. Cox. When Mr. Neal decided to bring up the summary judgment and the issue of law, the case had been going on for some time, and then the summary judgment was filed. I don't know why it had been going on for that period of time. I think that the case probably filed pretty close to before the statute.
That takes us to 88, but what happened in the intervening 4 years? You don't know. No explanation.
From what I understand, I think that the situation is involved in being violated. This case involves Ms. Cox, who was hurt, injured, when she slipped and fell in the educational building of the Evergreen Church, which is in Cold Springs, Texas. The facts are laid out in the brief that we submitted with the court. Ms. Cox was taking her child to the daycare center in this church. She was a member of the church. However, contrary to some of the allegations in brief, she was not on the administrative board at the time this incident occurred. When she walked into the education...
But she had been on it?
Yes, Your Honor, she had been on the administrative board at one time.
She was not at that time?
That's what my understanding is, Your Honor. When she walked into the educational building, the floor was wet, she slipped and fell, suffered a ruptured disc. When she walked into this educational building, she walked in there to take her son to the daycare center. She wasn't going there to worship. She was going there to take her son to the daycare center. Part of our allegations and our complaint is that she went in there as an invitee, which she felt should be secondary on that issue to her status as a member of the church. The issue, of course, in this case is that there's allegations, and I believe the evidence has showed that the Evergreen Church, at the time this injury occurred, was an unincorporated association.
Counsel, wouldn't we have to overrule a number of cases in order for your client to prevail?
Your Honor, the cases that the court has, the Supreme Court case of the United Association of Journeymen versus Borden, which is a 1959 Supreme Court case, and I believe there's two other cases, Your Honor, the Atkinson case and also the Allen case. All of those All of those cases, Your Honor, we brought this up in our petition. We still feel it's a case of first impression in a sense. All these cases dealt with labor unions. I don't think, and I've researched the area in this case, I don't believe there's any case that has come before this court where a member of a church, an unincorporated religious association, has sued that religious association for personal injury. I don't know if it's because of this case law and the labor union cases.
This church just happens to have a large insurance policy, which somebody favored us with telling us about. If they didn't, or assuming that the damages exceed the amount of that coverage, who's liable under your theory? Any member?
Judge,
just the assets of this organization?
If it did go over the insurance policy, I would assume that the assets of the church or the church would be liable.
How about the individual members?
The individual members, Judge, I don't feel, first of all, that we could assert a claim against them.
Why not? Now, if this were a partnership or a joint enterprise, you could, right?
Yes, sir.
It's a corporation, you couldn't.
That's correct.
Now, what have other states done, or how would you propose that we draw lines? were we to get to that position in this case?
Judge, the other states that I've cited in this case, I believe Ohio, Indiana, of course, have allowed suits against the Unincorporated Association. They've allowed those suits based on a rule of law which they had in their statutes, which is closely akin to our Rule 28 in our Rules of Civil Procedure. However, I'm aware from this, from the court and from the statutes, from the evidence in this case, that at this point in time, Rule 28 is a procedural rule, not a substantive rule. However, the courts in those states fashion their ruling where they could sue the Unincorporated Association from statutes which are closely resembling our Rule 28, which holds that an unincorporated association can sue or be sued in its name. In this case, it's our contention, Ms. Cox, unless you can sue this unincorporated association church, has no redress.
Well, I'm not asking about it from that end. I'm asking from the other end. What? Who is liable? Who can be liable? And how do you draw the line? And what legal principles?
In this case, Judge, a member of the church laid down the tile in this case. She could sue that member.
That's already the case right now.
Yes, sir.
I'm talking about under your rule. Where would you draw the line on who can be liable? And how would you make that a principle line drawing?
If the court is telling me, my rule would be you can sue the Unincorporated Association, that's my theory. In this case, of course, they have an insurance policy. However, I'm aware that an insurance policy shouldn't create a cause of action where you don't have one anyway.
Counsel, does Article 6122 and 6138 apply?
Judge, I'm not aware of those articles.
Suing an unincorporated, you're not conscious of 6122, not aware of.
Judge, the only rules I'm aware of is the case law that is stated in those labor union cases.
And you cited Rule 28.
Yes, sir. Which, of course, is the rule that states that they can be sued or be sued in the name of an unincorporated association. The only law that I'm aware of, and I don't even think it is a law, it's case law. But it deals with the labor unions, and these are these 1959 cases. I don't know of any statutory law in state in Texas that you cannot sue an unincorporated association. I'm not aware of that.
If you sue, if you can sue them, are the members liable?
If you can sue the unincorporated association?
Yes, sir. Are the members liable?
I believe they would be, Your Honor.
So if you join this church, you better know that if somebody falls down out there, you may have to pay for it.
That's true, Judge. That's true.
Kind of make you wary of going to church, wouldn't it?
Well, it would. On that point, Your Honor, there have been discussions in the case, in this particular case, and it does concern me because I think it's an important, it's an emotional issue for a lot of reasons. But I also think that if you go to a church, you ought to feel safe in going to that church. If you get
safe from whom?
Well, what I'm saying, Your Honor, is if you go to church and if you can get hurt there and you have no redress, I think that that would serve a purpose in destroying any harmony or tranquility within that church, within spiritual worship in that church.
Should a church be liable for negligent or only intentional acts?
Judge, I believe they ought to be liable for both. And I think in the case law, in the Borden case, they carved an exception in that case as far as the labor union's liability, that if it was an intentional act, that labor union could be liable. However, if it was a negligent act, they could not be liable. I'm having a problem understanding that distinction. I think in both cases, it ought to be either negligence or intentional.
Well, if the distinction is that by joining a union, you ought not to subject yourself to liability for someone falling on the premises, why doesn't that same principle apply to churches?
I think in the labor union cases, you've got a lot of issues. Number one, that you don't have in the church, you don't have grievance procedures, you don't have workers' compensation, you don't have the avenues of redress that a union member has within a union. That was pointed out in my brief. In a church setting, the only things you have, of course, is the right to enjoy spiritual fellowship with the other members. You do not have any severable rights to any of the funds or property of the church. I believe that's the main distinction between the two. I think in the union situation, you have other avenues of redress. You don't have that in the church. In this case, Ms. Cox has no redress other than the church.
If all the members of the church are liable, is the amount of their liability based upon frequency of attendance at church, the amount that they donate towards the church, or is it simply equal liability for everyone who has entered the church to worship?
Hard question, Judge. I don't think it has to do with the frequency. I think it more has to do with equal liability in the situation. All I'm saying is that what my contention in this case is that the association, the unincorporated association with this policy, should be treated as a separate entity to sue.
There's no doubt, of course, that all those members are personally liable if a non-member has the same experience your client had.
Yes, sir.
So if the city's leading atheist walked in that day taking her child to the child care center, all the members of the church could be individually liable if she'd been hurt.
That's true.
Do you know of any reason why the law should impose or draw a distinction between the rights of the atheist non-member and the person who's a loyal churchgoer in that association?
I don't believe you.
And if the church members are concerned in the unincorporated association about the danger of liability to their own members and somehow think that that is a greater danger than the liability they already have as to all non-members, do they have the option of incorporating to insulate themselves from that liability?
Yes, they do.
Isn't that what happened here 2 years after the incident?
The church incorporated, I believe, in 1989.
And can you, similar to some of the questions that Justice Doggett was asking you, can you think of any rationale that would support a distinction between an unincorporated association for which it has immunity from suit under these circumstances and a sole proprietorship, a partnership, a nonprofit corporation, or for-profit corporation, any other form of ownership?
I really can't. I can't distinguish that, Judge. The only thing that I can see is if you incorporate, you're insulated. If you're an unincorporated association, you're not insulated. Or you are insulated. I'm sorry. But if you're a corporation, you can be sued as an entity. I don't understand the general law or general rule that's been applied in the state since 59 from these labor union cases. That's why we're here. I don't understand why there should be a difference that a non-member can sue or the member cannot sue. Or the principal agency rule or the common law rule, whatever that rule is. I see no basis for it. That's why we're here.
If you can sue a church, you ought to be able to sue a union.
Sorry, Your Honor.
If you can sue a church, you ought to be able to sue the union. I mean, your case really argues against the union precedence.
That's true, Your Honor. In this case, we did bring the suit, and we feel that Ms. Cox has standing to sue the church. We feel that she has no avenues of redress. She cannot, as far as we can see in this case, pursue a claim as the pastor, as the individual member. And I think that's where insurance comes into play. And I still understand the distinction that insurance really shouldn't make the difference, but it does in a sense in this case. They had an insurance policy with Allstate, a $300,000 policy. The pastor of this church, in the fact situation, in the fact scenario, basically admitted that the church was negligent and or grossly negligent.
Was the church negligent as a unit, or were there some individuals that were negligent?
The daycare center, Your Honor, had workers who had a responsibility to maintain and clean the floors who worked with the church. An individual member laid the tile down on the floor, which blended in as far as the color, which was slick. He was a member of the church.
What was that person? hired by the church to do this job, or was it a volunteer?
I believe what happened was that this man was a contractor, but he's also a member of the church, and I think there was some compensation involved there. However,
the daycare worker was indeed employed at the time, the person
correct.
Who did not mop up or
yes, Your Honor.
Put out a warning sign. And so I assume the church could buy an insurance policy that would cover the acts of their workers and did not choose to do so here.
The insurance policy they had was a liability policy, covering liability in this case, $300,000 policy of Ball State. The church board of trustees, in fact, had recommended to the insurance company to pay Ms. Cox's damages, and they felt it was warranted up to the limits of liability in this case. And there was a letter to that effect. Pastor Jones, who...
Well, that's not really my question. But my question was, could the church have bought coverage for the acts of the employees, the daycare worker?
I assume they could have.
Any other questions?
What was the pastor's testimony about his negligence as a cause of any damages exceeding $300,000?
The deposition of Pastor Jones, in his deposition, he stated, and we have that in this room, that he was aware that this floor was dangerous before this incident happened, that it would get wet, that kids, children, and people could slip on the floor of the pool, that he knew about it on that morning, that he should have put warning signs out there, that they didn't do that, and that it was a dangerous situation. He was aware of this before this happened, and was aware of it the morning before this happened. And that's, in a nutshell, what his testimony was.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Court is ready to hear arguments from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Michael Neal will speak for respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Mike Neal. I represent the Evergreen Church respondent. I'm prepared to address the issues of the sufficiency of the summary judgment and the public policy arguments concerning the protection of an unincorporated association from being sued by one of the principals in that association for the negligence of all of the principals in that association.
Could you address, I think, Justice Doggett's question earlier, why there should be a distinction in the law between a non-member and the liability of the members of the unincorporated association, and depending on whether you're a member or non-member, and then secondly, why it should make a legal difference in the nature of the business association that actually owns the property.
Well, the protection of the unincorporated association against this type of suit is based on principal and agency law. That is, that all of the members of the association are co-principals in that association, and therefore they all have equal obligations, equal rights, and equal interests in that unincorporated association. And the act of one is the act of all of the principals of that association. So if the association is negligent, and this is based on established law of principal nature, if the association is negligent, then that negligence is the negligence of all the principals, including the member who has brought the action. And to follow with that even further, to follow Justice Phillips' question, if that principal, if that co-principal is allowed to bring suit and get a judgment against the association, that is against all of the co-principals, she in essence has a judgment against herself.
Does that same rule apply to partners and partnership?
I'm not prepared to answer that, Your Honor. I would think that if two partners were in an automobile, say a small partnership, my law partner, I've got one partner, we're going down to the courthouse and had an accident because of the negligence of whichever partner was driving, I don't see a cause of action against the partnership as an entity by one of the two partners, but a cause of action against the other partner for his individual negligence. I don't know, and I have not prepared to address that distinction other than to make that policy argument, so to speak.
Suppose a partnership employee hits one of the partners, negligently backs over them. They out of luck as far as the partnership and the
any in terms of any recovery?
I think that possibly their only recourse would be against that employee individually for that individual's negligence. I don't see why they should have a cause of action against the partnership because an employee of the partnership of which they are a joint principal then.
Is there anything in this record, your opposing counsel made some reference to a $300,000 Allstate policy. Is there anything about the insurance policy in this record?
I do not believe there is. There's not been any proof of the terms and conditions of the policy that was not made part of the summary judgment evidence.
To the extent that we accept the rule that you're suggesting, doesn't it mean, regardless of what the insurance situation is here, that if a partnership purchases insurance, a law firm, an insurance partnership, any kind of partnership, or an unincorporated association purchases insurance, it has unknowingly purchased insurance that provides coverage for everybody except its own members. It has effectively written them out with that interpretation of the law.
Well, that would be true in the context that they would be accepted under workers' compensation principles also under that policy as employees of the partnership, assuming that they've got the coverage that provides coverage for
well,
them.
Well, you're actually leading to my next question, but as far as the one I'm asking now, doesn't it really mean that every law firm that is a partnership, and of course there are many other kinds of business partnerships and unincorporated associations that has an insurance policy in Texas today, under your interpretation, they may not know it, but they have an exception in our policy that they cannot recover on their own insurance policy for any injury to themselves. They can only protect and insure against injury and harm to non-members of the partnership or non-members of the association.
I'm not sure what that question is exactly, but my response to it is, as a partner in my own partnership, I don't think that I would expect the coverage that I purchased to cover me or to cover my partner for their negligent acts directly.
If you wanted to, you could buy first-party insurance, could you not?
I certainly could.
Employees?
We certainly could. And we could also, it's arguable, and as Your Honor has pointed out, this policy is not before the court, but depending on the terms and conditions of the policy, it's arguable that there may be coverage for the acts of individual employees of the unincorporated association or for the individuals as members of that unincorporated association. I don't know, we haven't developed that in this case. That policy is not before the court, but that's...
Separate coverage that you say, that to the extent we have any concern about the impact of our decision on insurance law or insurance policy coverage that could be obtained to cover employee acts, is that what you're saying?
Well, I don't think that there's any evidence before the court in the form of the summary judgment evidence or anything
right.
to make that determination. But we don't know one way or the other whether or not the policy, the general liability policy covering the unincorporated associations would in effect cover individual members of that association as principals for their independent acts of negligence when they're acting on behalf of that association. I would think there may be some argument that may be the case, but I don't know that policy is not before the court.
Let me go to the employee injury situation that your earlier comment raised. Let's suppose that this church feels more comfortable with the quality of work it gets if all of its paid full-time employees are church members. And one of those church members, through the negligence of a co-worker, is injured on the job. Have any right of recovery against the church?
You're talking about a member of the church.
Right, who's a full-time paid employee. They're working not in this capacity as a church member, but the church likes to have church members as employees, and so the full-time employee is hurt on the job.
Well, there's so much we could throw into that. If we have
a policy of
workers' compensation.
For right now, they don't have workers' compensation.
All right. Then they would have to bring a common law cause of action. My understanding is they'd bring an action against whatever individuals caused their injury.
They could not sue the church?
No, that is my position, that they are a co-principal in that unincorporated association, and they are in essence under established law of principal and agent. They are suing themselves as a co-principal.
And you say if the church has workers' compensation insurance, it's different?
Oh, I would certainly, if they're in the capacity of an employee, they're suing the insurance carrier when they're bringing an action under the Workers' Compensation Act and not suing the unincorporated association.
Thank you.
To carry it on a little bit further, what if Ms. Cox were the most solvent member of the unincorporated association, and this is a church down in the woods in East Texas with mostly members of modest means? She gets a judgment against the unincorporated association of which she is a principal and the most solvent member. Does she collect the judgment against herself? How do you apportion the liabilities of the various members of this organization? If there's a local individual who calls himself a member of the church but only attends church occasionally on Christmas and Easter, otherwise does not participate in the church, and he owns 1,000 acres of farmland, is he liable for the judgment of a member of the church against the members of the church?
In that regard, I gather your distinction is, as far as who is a member of the unincorporated association, that they have to have done whatever the unincorporated association says make them a member. If the unincorporated association says being a regular attendee makes them a member, does that suffice?
Well, this goes to the practicality of why it should be against public policy to be able to sue the unincorporated association. There is no set standard. There is no law, no statute that defines unincorporated association. There's no definitive standard for membership in an unincorporated association, and it may be a very formal procedure depending on the unincorporated association that requires very strict formal procedures to become a member, or it may be that they just consider all the people that happen to walk through the doors of the church on Sunday as members.
Do you see any application of Rule 28 or Article 6133 here?
Your Honor, 6133, I have to plead the same thing that Mr. Capolino did. I'm assuming that is the partnership law, but I'm not sure about that. Rule 28, I do not believe applies. All that Rule 28 does is sets up a procedural method of suing an unincorporated association among other entities. But Rule 28 goes on further that upon motion of the party, the actual named party has to be named as a defendant. And I think that in this situation, that if proper motion was made, that the plaintiff would have to name the members of the unincorporated association as parties rather than an unincorporated association. And Mr. Capolino has pointed out that other jurisdictions have allowed, under a similar rule, suits against unincorporated associations. Those states are Ohio, California, and Indiana. And if you look at the cases that he cited, the Tanner case, the Joseph case, and the Cox versus White case, in all of those states there is a statute enacted or approved by the legislature or the General Assembly in the case of the Tanner case that establishes an unincorporated association as a separate legal entity for a natural person. Rule 28 doesn't do that. It can't do that.
So you're saying that the distinction of the only, what is it, three jurisdictions is that in those states there is a statutory definition of unincorporated
association. That is correct.
Going back to Judge Hightower's question about Article 6133, I think there or somewhere in the adjacent articles, there is some reference to unincorporated joint stock companies and associations. And I would just say that if either you or opposing counsel, who had the same familiarity with it that you do, think that it has any applicability in this case, once you get back to the office, why don't you send us a letter following up and offer us any thoughts you have on it?
Thank you, Your Honor. Beyond that, Your Honors, it's just established law of principal and agent, and as a practical matter, given the fact that an unincorporated association can be anything from the ladies' afternoon tea club that meets every Thursday afternoon at one of the members' homes, that's arguably an unincorporated association. And say you have 5, 10 folks that get together and have snacks and tea or whatever, and one of them get sick because of some contaminated snacks. Do they have the right to sue the group as a whole, or is there a cause of action against the individual? An unincorporated association can be just such a broad spectrum of collections of people. That's what it's defined as under in Black's Law Dictionary, as we pointed out in our brief. It's a collection of people that have a common purpose. That can be anywhere from 2 to 10,000 people in the case of a large labor union that might not be incorporated, as apparently the labor unions in the Borden case, the Allen case, and the Atkinson case were. And where do you draw the line? The courts, in some of the cases in California, White versus Cox, have carved out a condominium association where you've got definitive membership, the owners of the condominium units. You've got... you can determine how much interest each member of that association has in that particular association. And in fact, this court in Dutcher versus Owens has, in the case of third-party actions against the condominium association, limited the liability of a condominium association, of the members of the condominium association, to the ownership interest of each member in that condominium. You can't do that with some amorphous group of people that may have members coming and going and so forth. You don't have a definitive membership organization where you can say that each person has a definitive interest in this organization. As Justice Cook pointed out, you determine the liabilities of the parties based on how often they go to church, how much they contribute to the church, and so forth.
But if you have such an organization and they decide, though, even though they just sit around and visit, and it's kind of a irregular sort of organization, but if they decide to buy an insurance policy and some non-member sues them, then they have done a wise thing in having that policy.
Certainly. I would think that anybody would do a wise thing to be insured for contingent liabilities.
But we're just not going to let them sue if they're a member.
Well, I don't think insurance, and I may be in contradiction with some of the members of the court, but I don't think insurance should determine the rights of people to bring or not to bring suits.
Except if the insurance is to protect the rights of people.
But we don't have any evidence before this court that that's what this policy was for, or that it was not for that purpose. An insurance policy is purchased to insure against the risks and the liabilities that might be brought. It's not there to waive defenses or exceptions to that liability, and it shouldn't be. It shouldn't be there to just provide payment to a party that brings a suit because they brought a suit. If there are exceptions to liability, if there are defenses to liability, those exceptions and defenses still exist, regardless of insurance. Insurance is purchased to protect
the I think I agree with you in that regard. Is there any basis, though, for defining a rule to protect members of unincorporated associations from negligence of that association, at least to the extent of the assets of the association, which would, of course, include insurance policy if they had one, and wouldn't if they didn't have one?
Well, there might be that, but how are you going to define the assets of the association? That may not always be clear. In this case, I would submit that it probably wouldn't be clear as to what the assets of this particular association is. That's not before the court, but how do we know what the assets of an association are?
Well, I guess the same way as you do of anything else. You have to do discovery about it. Maybe it doesn't have it.
But an association is not a separate legal entity. Can it own title to any assets? Can it own title to real estate? Can it own title
to... that's an interesting comment. So what about the school here where this accident occurred? Wasn't it owned by the Evergreen Church?
Well, this is not before the court, but my understanding is this entire property is owned by the Methodist Church, the United Methodist Church, who had disenfranchised this particular congregation, and they had become an independent congregation, but they had no title ownership, anything. They had control of the premises, apparently.
Were they the possessor of the premises use that term under...
I would argue that the association, the co-principal, is probably in possession of the premises. But still, that doesn't give them ownership of the premises and would not subject to any assets to any liability.
Under the broad definition which you've given us of an unincorporated association, assume that five or six judges regularly have lunch together. The driver of the vehicle causes an accident injuring a third party. Would any or all of the five or six judges be personally liable as an unincorporated association?
Well, my personal feeling is that that would be bad law, and I don't know. I wouldn't want to have to hold a judgment against the unincorporated association of judges. I would want to have a judgment against those judges individually, which is what I think should have been done in this case, that the individuals, the pastor has said he knew that the floor was wet and it was dangerous. He knew that a sign should have been there. Arguably, the pastor could be in possession of the premises because he runs the day-to-day operation of church. Why didn't they sue the pastor individually? Then make the argument that there's coverage under this liability policy for the pastor as a co-principal in the unincorporated association. That would make it a much cleaner case. That would
the pastor would not
us,
be liable, would he, unless he affirmatively created a condition himself?
No, I think that the Corbin versus Safeway principle would apply here. If he's a person in possession, he's
in possession. You think he was a possessor of the premises?
Well, he's testified that he was there every day, that he pretty much ran the operations of the church. He was aware of the dangerous condition, that he thought there should have been a sign there.
Well, under that theory, I guess anybody who went to the church on a daily basis would be a possessor.
I think that in this particular instance, maybe the people running the daycare center, the individual parties running the daycare center, could arguably be in possession. The pastor could arguably be in possession. Those people could have been sued individually.
Under Carbon versus Safeway, are you of the belief that the manager of the Safeway store is individually liable then?
Well, in Carbon versus Safeway, we've got a corporation that has possession of the premises. Yes, I think that very often we see individuals sued individually for their negligence. We see truck drivers sued.
Certainly, but in terms of the comparison to Carbon against Safeway, of a pastor who would be sued just because he happened to be kind of the head of the operation, is the same principle apply as you read Carbon v. Safeway against the manager of the Safeway, even if he did not individually create the hazard?
I quoted Corbin versus Safeway just to talk about the standards of a everyday slip and fall case, but I think that if that manager were to be deposed and if he were to say, I personally knew about the danger, I personally could have mopped it up, I chose not to do so, yes, there is an argument for individual liability against him and he could be sued.
If you ever find a deposition like that, send it on up here. let me ask you just one last question. I see your light's on. And I'm not very comfortable with this kind of a bright line, but what about an attempted bright line test that would draw a distinction for members of unincorporated associations being able to get to the assets of the unincorporated association when they're injured in the course of some non-association related activity, such as apparently occurred here, that she's not there as a church member, but she's there delivering a child to a related service?
Well, I still see problems that you're abrogating the co-principal argument in principle and agency law, and you could be opening a Pandora's box in that area of the law by making that distinction in this particular case. I see the practical problems of determining what are assets of a of an association, if somebody has loaned a computer to the association that's sitting there in an office, is that an asset of the corporation? I just think as a practical matter, the legislature has not chosen yet, maybe they should, to define unincorporated associations, to define the membership, to define the liabilities of those members. And I think that that should be done before imposing liability on them in contradiction to the established law of principal and agent, that is, their co-principals.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
As brief as I can in my rebuttal. Mr. Neal mentioned that individuals could have been sued in this case. I don't really think that is the case. If we sued individuals in this case, we could potentially have 100 individuals. And the Carvin case, from what I understand, the premises liability law, that the owner of the premises is liable, which would be an entity, a corporation, in this sense, an unincorporated association. Also, with an analogy between an afternoon tea club and this church and state care center. I have to see a distinction there. First of all, if somebody comes to an afternoon tea club at somebody's house, if there's an association, there's a potential for homeowners insurance there. I can see that. I can't really tell this course that insurance doesn't make a difference in this case. I think it does make a difference in this case. I'm not to be the type of person that's going to go out to churches to try to get their assets. And I think it is important in this case.
If there weren't insurance, would you be here?
Judge, I think I'm here just for the principle that Ms. Cox has no regrets in this situation.
If there weren't, would you be here?
I probably would, Your Honor. But I think it's important. And also, as far as the insurance in this case is concerned, there was reference to the insurance in the record of this case, the summary judgment, which is mentioned in our brief, that the Board of Trustees notified Allstate Insurance Company in the record at trial pages 159, 160, supplemental trial pages 105, 116, 121. And also supplemental trial page 121, where the Board of Trustees and Pastor Jones did send a letter to the insurance company reflecting their intent for the petitioner to be compensated for her injuries. That was in this case and is in the record. And they did mention the insurance and they thought it was warranted. As far as public policy on this case, this court in recent years has decided two other cases dealing with interspousal immunity, intrafamily immunity, and Price versus Price and Jelani versus Jelani. And basically, I can see the principles in those cases were, before they were cited, that husband cannot sue wife, or wife cannot sue the husband because they're one and the same. This court did away with that principle, finding there was no basis for it. Found that the domestic tranquility would not be destroyed in those cases. And the judges all spoke to those issues. I think it's the same situation here. You have an unincorporated association, the situation being that they are one and the same. I think Ms. Cox has a right to sue the unincorporated association in this case. I think that there should be a situation or an exception where she can sue this unincorporated association. Point blank, she has no redress other than this, and she has severe injuries. In Jelani, the court allowed children to sue the parents in automobile collisions. The court spoke on that. Justice Mousey spoke in his concurring opinion about the basis for that opinion and about domestic tranquility and harmony of the family unit not being destroyed. I think it's real important in this case that those cases be looked at as this court has evolved the case law, continuing to evolve it into this case.
Counsel, there was a case several years ago involving an insurance company. It was a direct suit against an insurance company for refusal to pay a claim. And the company was relying on a 1952 case out of the Waco Court of Appeals that had been refused by the Supreme Court. It essentially held that when you have co-insureds, and one of them is culpable in the destruction of insured property, that wrongdoing is imputed to the innocent co-insureds, and the principle that you shouldn't benefit from your own wrongdoing applies. It also was supported by the fiction, I suppose, that you can't sue yourself, and you stay, the co-insureds stand in one another's shoes. In that particular case, and of course, the rationale behind the wrongdoers rule was that when you have co-insureds, the case is susceptible to fraud and collusion between them in order to acquire the proceeds of coverage. This court changed that rule unanimously at that time to require that the insurance company establish fraud or collusion or any legal basis for denying a claim, that the fact that these people stood in one another's shoes was a fiction. That was, the facts of that particular case was counterproductive to the reason for the underlying rule, to pursue it to that illogical extreme. Is this a similar situation?
I think it is.
Basically, the reason behind the rule is you can't sue yourself. You're all members of the same unincorporated association. But here you have a person who, to create another fiction, if you will, that's just as reasonable in the real world, is there in their capacity as a patron and not as a member.
Judge, I think it is the same principle. And I think it is a legal fiction.
Just as if the church owned a parking lot, the employee of the church was driving a church-owned vehicle across the parking lot, and one of the parishioners or members of the association was walking across the parking lot, and the employee driving the church-owned vehicle ran over, and under this argument here, that person would not be able to sue the entity.
I think it's the same principle, Your Honor. And again, I don't see how the fact situation in my particular case shows that whatever this church didn't do, their omissions, was for the benefit of my client. And I think she has a right to sue the church in this situation. And I think it is a legal fiction. And I think it needs to be addressed. And I think it needs to be changed.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court will take another brief recess.
Thank you.